You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk 106 to 108 FM, coming from the News Talk studios at Spices Sage Call, according to What Three Words. Ron says, and he's right, it'd be great at festivals, handy for finding friends and even your tent. Are the word combinations adjacent, somebody else wants to know, or if you're meeting at table, chair, spoon, and they're at tablespoon, chair, are you spitting distance from each other or continents apart? I don't know, but I'm guessing that probably... They have more random collections of words just so to avoid that eventuality. Spices Sage Call is really not much of a combination there. Can you ask to make sure my house is covered in Clare posts for ever getting lost on the way to me? This would be a godsend. Well, they say they've divided every bit of the planet into these 3 meter squares. So yes, it is covered. Though of course, the important thing is that whoever delivers your post is going to have that app. So they can find your house. And someone else says tanks are exempt from the congestion charge in London. I did not know that. Now, in June of this year, it will be the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, the conflict that put Gaza and the West Bank effectively under Israeli control. News Talk's foreign correspondent Shona Murray is just back from a visit there. Shona, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Now, legally, internationally, what is the status of Palestine as opposed to what is the legal status of Palestine as far as Israel is concerned? Is there a difference there? I assume there is.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, international law, International Court of Justice, the UN, the EU, all major international institutions recognise the Palestinian territories to be occupied, the West Bank, Gaza and parts of East Jerusalem. Now, Israel denies that it's an occupation. It says that the land is disputed because there was no land of Palestine there before 1948 and 1967 after the 1967 war. But as I said, the international community says that it is occupied, and the law that applies there is the Geneva Conventions, because under occupation or war or armed conflict, the laws of war apply. So it's the Fourth Geneva Convention that applies there. And the reason why that's relevant is that there are very specific rules and regulations when you're an occupying power. One of the things you're not allowed to do is transfer your people onto the land that you're occupying, which makes the settlements completely prohibited under the Geneva Conventions.
Mm. But they're doing that
anyway,
at a pace anyway. Well, has Israel passed any legislation formally legalises these settlements then?
I mean, the government legalises the settlements. So, but it hasn't. It's an interesting thing, because when you're under, when you're an occupying power, it's the military that carries everything out, because like we said, it's the laws of armed conflict. So it's not really the Knesset that engages in it, it's the military. So it's kind of just, they just sort of sneak up as time goes by and they develop into these. I mean, the thing is about settlements in Israel as well. Some of them are beautiful settlements, as Mali Adumin, which is one that is, you know, it's quite a luxurious place to live. But when you to go there, you get a lot of tax exemptions as well. So it's a great draw for people. And of course, Israel is a beautiful country, the Palestinian territory, the whole region. So who wouldn't want to live there? You have swimming pools. Then you have also other types of settlers, which would be religious fundamentalist settlers. And these people would live in really dire conditions just for the sake of occupying what is Jewish land, because it's such an important place for the Jewish people, as well as the Muslims, as well as Christians. So that's the whole issue. So you have people who are, you know, really engaging in violent acts against Palestinians in the West Bank for the sake of what they see as Judea and Samaria, which is the biblical Hebrew name for the West Bank. And their conditions aren't very nice. They live in sort of settlements that aren't fully supported by the government, but certainly not going to be removed anytime soon for the government. And then you have, you know, you probably heard a lot about SodaStream and some of the companies that operate in the West Bank. They're given incredible tax exemptions to go and work there in these business parks. Actually, since then, SodaStream has actually pulled out of the West Bank. And they're sort of economic settlements as well, just to draw industry into those areas. And what you have is then Palestinians have to work there because they can't get any other work elsewhere. So that's a bit of an issue too. So it's all very complicated, and it is religiously infused in many ways, but also, you know, it's also an economic place for people to actually live and enjoy life in one of the most wonderful places in the world.
So presumably then, if settlements aren't legal under international law, at least the wall isn't either.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. I mean, the wall is very controversial. It was built around the time of the Second Intifada. People remember in the early 2000s in Jerusalem, there were very many suicide attacks engaged in by Hamas. And so the reaction by the Israelis was to build this wall around the West Bank. It's about 1.5 times the size of the Berlin Wall, but it snakes into Palestinian land, and that's the issue. It's built on occupied land. It's not built on Israel proper, as they call it, which is the sort of green line which the international community recognises as the state of Israel. So it's built on Palestinian land, and the effect it sort of snakes into people's farms, so people are cut off from their farms, and then you have all these checkpoints that for a farmer to get to his land, for example, could take several hours to get there because he has to go through a checkpoint. Or you have Palestinians who work in Jerusalem and they live in Bethlehem, and they have they have to get through the checkpoint. Sometimes the Israelis decide they're going to close the checkpoint randomly, or that they'll close it at 11 o'clock in the morning. I remember being in a checkpoint in Qalqilya in West Bank a couple of years ago, and it was August and it was searing heat, and I'll never forget this. There was a man and his wife, and he was carrying a 3-year-old child, and the woman went through the checkpoint, and then the two IDF soldiers, who are 19 probably, just decided to not let him pass, and it was searing heat and the child was crying, and they just started literally dancing, you know, in front of him. Mm. I mean, just that sort of mental approach towards the Palestinians. It was really, really disgusting to watch. So it's that sort of implication for the West Bank Wall is what the International Court of Justice says is why it's illegal, because it's a disproportionate use of force. And they also say that militarily it's not necessary. I mean, like I said, it's the laws of war that apply here. So Israel as an occupying power is entitled to protect its civilians. But it's when it's not militarily necessary, then it's essentially a breach of the Geneva Conventions, which could be a war crime. So that's the issue there. I mean, the thing is, on the other side, there hasn't been any suicide attacks in Jerusalem since they built the wall. So if you look at that sort of correlation, you could say, well, hold on a minute. You know, for the sake of a few Palestinians' lives being disturbed, I'd prefer to have the protection of the wall rather than to, worry about going into a pizza shop in Jerusalem and be blown up. But then, I mean, actually, the wall doesn't cover the whole land. So if Hamas did want to go to Jerusalem or Tel Aviv with a suicide belt, they'd probably do that as well. So the other thing is that Hamas has just stopped using that as a terror tactic. They prefer to send rockets into Israel through Gaza instead, or other ways.
And we'll get to that. Though, yeah. First, though, you do have a clip.
I do. Yeah, that's right.
Exemplifies how people's lives are disturbed by this wall.
Exactly. This is Sharouk. She's a teacher in the school in the village of Abdullah Yunus in the West Bank, and she just told me about some of the obstacles for her life now because of it.
So as you see around, if you look just a few meters away from here, you will see an Israeli settlement. Settlers are all over around us.
What's the name of the settlement there?
Shu'isam al-Mustafa.
Katsir.
It's not just that they are here. They harass us on a daily basis. Every day we have to face attacks by the Israeli settlers who live in these settlements. Sometimes young Palestinians from this community are arrested by the Israeli army. By blocking us from accessing the West Bank, by having us behind the wall, we can't be part of the West Bank. We can't see our families on that side. And at the same time, we are not allowed to enter inside Israel. When I gave birth, for example, I was stopped at this checkpoint and they said, you can't go back. After I delivered in a West Bank hospital, I was going back home to my family with the newborn. At the checkpoint, they didn't allow me to enter back to my home in this village. They said that the checkpoint is closed. So you can imagine, I was carrying my kid, after 1 week old only, myself, after all the pain that I've suffered, and then you had to go back to the hospital because they decided suddenly to close the checkpoint.
Now, as you said, the West Bank is essentially under military control. So does the IDF then protect all the people who live there, or are they really there, de facto there, to protect the Israeli settlements?
Yeah, I mean, under international law, they should be protecting all of the civilians. Again, very specific in the Geneva Conventions that the occupying power has to support all the civilians, not just its own. But actually, the way it works in a lot of the settlements in places like Hebron is that the Palestinians are under military rule and the settlers are under civilian rule, which actually has huge implications for the way you can behave. So under military law, internment is legal for security reasons. So kids who are throwing stones get interned in the middle of the night. You have the IDF coming to your home 3 o'clock in the morning and arresting a 10-year-old kid or a 14-year-old kid. They put them in a military prison, adult prison, for 5 months, 6 months without seeing their family for the sake of throwing stones. Whereas the settlers could engage in any sort of attack or, you know, maybe throwing stones themselves, and then it's the police that deal with them. And obviously, you know yourself, in any civilian or situation, throwing stones is not really something that would get you exactly that. So that's a real huge implication. I mean, I actually, another thing I did before was I visited a military court where this kid who was 14 had been arrested for throwing stones, and in the end the judge let him off with 4 months and $500 fine. This family were very, very poor, and I remember talking to his mother afterwards, and she told me of the night that the Israelis went in to take her son. The kid ran into his parents' bedroom and begged the mother to protect him, and she said she couldn't, you know, she had to let him go. And it was heartbreaking, you know. It was totally, you know, unnecessary, you know. A kid, there wasn't even that much evidence against him. There was a photograph of him, but this is a kid in a I couldn't believe my eyes, a kid in a military court with adults with chains around his ankles. I mean, that's his life ruined, getting back to school, getting back to normal life. So it's huge implications. There is some incredible activist groups in Israel. One of them is a group called Breaking the Silence, which is former IDF soldiers who, because everybody in Israel does their military service, who after their military service kind of questioned what the point of it all was. Not the point of Israel defending itself. They're Zionists. They very much support their own country. But they felt that what they were doing was an occupation, supporting an occupation and engaging in disproportionate use of force. And this is Yehuda Shaul, who told me about his time in Hebron during the Second Intifada.
I made my presence felt day in, day out, day and night, 24/7. You know, the concept in the IDF says that if Palestinians will get the feeling that the army is all the time everywhere, so they'll be afraid to attack. You start a night shift patrol 10 o'clock till 6 o'clock in the morning, 8-hour shift in the old city of Hebron, bumping into a house. It's not a house we have intelligence about. It's a random house. Bump into the house, wake up the family, search the place. You can yourself imagine the dynamics, what happens when a military unit breaks into your house 2 o'clock at night. Finish searching the place, going out to the street, throwing some shock grenades, making some noise, knocking on some doors, running to the other corner of the old city, invading another house, waking the next family. And that's basically how we passed our 8-hour shift at night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The thing is that it's not only me. From September 2000, when the Second Intifada started, till today, it didn't stop for 1 second.
Did you discuss what they do to the families when they broke into their houses at two in the morning?
Some of the things that are really, really difficult to even hear, you know, for example, kids throwing stones, often they'd take them and they'd tie them up and put them in the sun. It's called a drying out. I mean, and it gets very hot in these places. But one of the incidents he told me was actually one of the days that he himself cracked.
You know, the level of poverty is nothing that I've seen before in my life, yeah? Like, I've seen during my military service, but not for my civilian life. It was like a one-room house, and you have like 7, 8, 9 people, okay, parents and children. They have these carpets on the floor, a pile of mattresses on one corner of the room, including the kitchen. Everything is in one place. We walk in, and, you know, we're searching for weapons. Now there's nothing. Yeah, they really have nothing. And we go in and we start to, you know, look through the pile of mattresses and pick up carpets and all these kind of stuff. The father comes to me and says, "What can I do? You know, the soldiers cut a few of my tires in the car for the second time." It was one of the few, that, like the first days when we took over. And the unit that we replaced was known to be very aggressive. And you kind of like, you see it, the guy really has nothing. And that was a moment for me of kind of like of a crack. And I basically, you know, I had nothing to say. But you're a commander. And, you know, right away I kind of like become this, you know, our soldiers don't behave this way. And we turn out and leave the place.
The chances of resolving this seem to be kind of incredibly difficult to the extent that it's so ingrained. And from the point of view of the new US administration, which I said, you know, varying degrees of effectiveness and even trying to get anywhere close to a peace deal, saying things like we might move the embassy to East Jerusalem, saying things like, ah, I don't really care if there's a one state or a two state solution. Does that help?
It doesn't help. But actually, so many US administrations have said that they're going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Clinton did even, and George W. Bush. But the repercussions are just so huge that they soon realised that you'd really be setting off the Third Intifada. But aside from that, both sides claim Jerusalem as their capital. So you're preordaining what should be a proper negotiation and a settlement on what the status of East Jerusalem is. And the US is supposed to be an independent broker. So that would cause huge repercussions. The other part about it is East Jerusalem, as I'm sure you know, is one of the most important places in the world. It's where, you know, the biblical temple is for Jewish people to pray, which is now the Western Wall. It's where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is, where this week or today on Holy Thursday, you'll have lots of Christians doing the Via Dolorosa, where a man named Jesus of Nazareth was crucified. And then you have the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. So the whole area needs to have a proper negotiation. So all the three Abrahamic religions can get access to it. And preordaining something which will cause major uprisings across the Middle East is not how you do that. So it's really, I think that the administration themselves have once, like all the others, have realised that that's just an impossibility.
Having said all that, just to be devil's advocate, the 1967 mandate had Jerusalem as an international zone. It was kind of vague around Palestine. Given that Israel invaded it, couldn't they not just argue under international law, well, we won, so we keep it?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, actually. I remember interviewing John Bolton, you know, the neocon guy, about this years ago, and he just turned to me and said, well, that's what happens in war. You lose territory, which is kind of true. I mean, but I put this point to Dr. Nabil Shah. He's the former acting Palestinian prime minister and lead Palestinian negotiator.
But that world of jungle supposedly ended with international law, with the United Nations, and with all kinds of guarantees that the world have really put in to make it impossible for countries to win territory and destroy people by war. I mean, if war will remain the what authenticates the rights of people, we are in a jungle again. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody in the world wants to repeat that jungle. So the fact that the Israelis occupied by war is recognized by Resolution 242 as being illegal. And not only that, but since then, every United Nations resolution, every Security Council resolution, every resolution by the European Union have reiterated the illegality of the occupation of the Palestinian territories by Israel and the illegality of building settlements in these territories, particularly in Jerusalem.
Now, of course, Israel will argue that it's doing all this for security purposes because of rocket attacks, etc. Right now, what is the security situation in Israel? Is there a high level of rocket attacks?
Actually, because on Sunday we had that blast in the Coptic churches in Egypt on Palm Sunday. Mm. And then the next day was Passover for the Jewish calendar. And when I was there, there was 8 rocket attacks that came from Sinai Peninsula as opposed to Gaza. And they were claimed by the Islamic State, which means the security situation in Israel, it does have to obviously secure itself and defend itself from rocket attacks from Gaza, for example, from Hamas. Now they have this threat from the Islamic State. So for sure, you have to support that. But the problem for groups like Breaking the Silence, the international community, is not about Israel's right to defend itself. It's about basically being an occupying power. But now, because of the greater threat in the Middle East, it means that the two-state solution is much, much further away because the trust just isn't there as well. So it's incredibly difficult situation, I think, for both sides. But the Palestinians can't understand why they have to be the collateral damage in all of this. The thing is, for sure, if you lived in Israel, if you were a Jewish person, I remember being in parts of Israel and seeing rockets attacks and having to go into war shelters when there are attacks. They don't kill that many people, but they are terrifying. And if you were to live like that for the past few decades, you would be concerned about your Palestinian neighbours and whether you can trust them. It just exists. I know it's a controversial thing to say, but if you've ever been in Jerusalem when there was a suicide attack, similarly, you would be concerned about your safety and you'd say, you know, build a wall. I don't care. I really need security above everything else. So it's an issue.
The standard international stance, the EU stance, and by extension Ireland's, is for a two-state solution. How robust is, say, Ireland's pushing of that view?
Yeah, so we have always had a very I hate to say pro-Palestinian, but let's say pro-two-state solution foreign policy, regardless of who's been in power. There was a debate in the Oireachtas about recognising formally Palestine. We haven't done it formally yet. Other countries have, France and Sweden. And the point is just to push the Israelis along, because to say, look, you're not getting away with this. We're going to have a two-state solution. You can't have people like Netanyahu talking about a one-state solution and letting this go. So I caught up with Nabil Shah and I asked him about Ireland's position. And he was actually very complimentary about Brian Cowan and Bertie Ahern more so than any other government.
I've been to Ireland several times, but the ones we were at the pinnacle of the call for recognition, I went to Dublin and met your foreign minister. And he knew what it's all about. I mean, I wanted to say, well, now that your parliament has recognized the state of Palestine, the majority of your people do, it's about time that you do that officially. On my way up, there was a store in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, first floor, that sells the Declaration of Independence of Ireland. So I bought two copies. And when I sat down, I gave him one copy and kept the other one. And he understood what it's all about. You declared your independence without the approval of Britain. Before there was even an agreement with Britain about the independence. And he understood. He said, all right, you are telling me now we should recognize the state of Palestine even before you reach an agreement with the Israelis. I said, but that's the only logic. You talk about the two-state solution. You recognize one, which is the occupier. You ought to recognize the other, which is the occupied, and urge the two to negotiate as two sovereign states to reach an agreement. Well, he thought it was logical, but he didn't do it.
Charlie Flanagan, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, yesterday, Mr. Cohen, who was your foreign minister when I was a foreign minister, sent me a message via LinkedIn. I had really lost touch with him for a while, I didn't know. But he really was a very... And Mr. Ahern, too. So during the period that the two were rulers, I was foreign minister. And Ireland was a 100% supporter.
There you go. I think that was Brian Cowan he was referring to rather than Brian Cohen, our little-known Jewish foreign secretary. Just one final thing, Shona, because you did mention Netanyahu has mentioned a one-state solution. I did a kind of a very rough tot in terms of population numbers. If you made it all one state, you'd have roughly 6.5 million Jews and 4.5 million Arabs, which would completely change the political dynamic within that one state. So they don't really want a one state solution at all.
Exactly that. There are a lot of Palestinians who would like a one state solution, because if you're living in the West Bank, you can't get anywhere. You'd like to just live in Israel then, wouldn't you? So you can get access to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. So they're like, look, we'll give up. Maybe it's for... I know young people in Palestine who say, I'm going to give up on the fight for the two state solution. I want to live a decent life. I want to be able to go to the Dead Sea, to Tel Aviv, to Jerusalem, and have equal rights and live in a democracy and forget about all this. So, but you're right. It's the numbers don't add up if you want it to be a Jewish state, because you could have also talks about the right to return for all Palestinians, but also which side would outbreed each other.
Shona Murray is News Talk's foreign correspondent. Shona, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.